Australian plains. The country is in the grip of the worst forest fires in its history. Murderous fires, as already over 100 people have been killed, according to a provisional estimate. Scorching temperatures reaching 47 degrees Celsius, with violent winds provoking a firestorm.
Conditions are some of the worst in living memory. A combination of scorching weather, drought, and tinder dry bush. On Saturday, temperatures in Melbourne soared to 46.4 degrees Celsius, the highest on record.
The death toll continues to rise from one of Australia's worst wildfires in history.
Radio EcoShock.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. While governments try to stall a global financial crash, the bankrupt atmosphere continues to erupt in fast death by fire and creeping bands of deserts. The Green Eden of species is emptying itself, the purge of climate shift. In this program, you'll hear one of Australia's top climate scientists on the deadly fires there and the forces that confront all of us, including here in North America. From Adelaide, Professor Barry Brook shares his valuable time with EcoShock listeners. I'll follow that up with an audio montage of growing deserts as warming pushes out the rainfall, exactly as Sir James Lovelock and the Hadley Center predicted. The American Southwest is falling into the same drying pattern as Australia, with the same fire risks. As you may have heard, Obama's new Energy Secretary, Stephen Chu, told the Los Angeles Times on February 4th, that agriculture may end in California by the end of this century. The snowpack in the Sierra Mountains, source of the rivers feeding California's irrigation, may fall by 90% due to global warming unless we find a way to stop it. California is the largest provider of vegetables, fruits, and other food stocks to the United States and to Canada. Secretary Chu also wondered whether the major cities of California are sustainable at all. Chu told the Times, quote, I don't think the American public has gripped in its gut what could happen. We're looking at a scenario where there's no more agriculture in California. I don't actually see how they can keep their cities going. Wow, that's right from the top. Southern Australia is having the same problems, but their catastrophe is more advanced, as you will hear next. In the second half of the program, guest host KMO, creator of the Sea Realm podcast, interviews Thomas Homer Dixon. He's the author of The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization. Find out what Wall Street investors can learn from the way nature responds to collapse. Then Homer Dixon reads from his new book, Carbon Shift, How the Twin Crises of Oil Depletion and Climate Change Will Define the Future. Lots to do, so let's get going to Australia, the warning to the world.
This is what used to be the main street of Marysville. What didn't burn simply melted.
The death toll from Australia's worst fire in a quarter of a century continues to rise.
Raging wildfires brought devastating deaths to Australia in the southern state of Victoria. The conflagration followed 3 days of sweltering, record-breaking heat. We wonder, could this be a warning about our future as climate change proceeds? Let's find out more about what is happening to Australia's climate with Professor Barry Brook. He's one of Australia's top young climate scientists and director of the Research Institute for Climate Change and Sustainability at the University of Adelaide. Barry, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
Our time together is kind of limited, so let's get right to the point. Are sudden heat waves and the following fires, are they what we would expect from climate change?
They're certainly what we would expect. These are extreme events, and as you change the average weather, then you change the extremes as well, and they get distorted such that events that were once very rare or never occurred can become quite common, even with what is apparently a small change in the average. So the heat waves that Australia has experienced in January and February of 2009 is extraordinary in the sense that it's very long and it's also the hottest heat wave on record, coming on top of a very dry drought.
It's strange for us because we picture that heat wave in the south, and yet there are storms, violent storms, with flooding in the north. What has changed for Australia's climate and why?
Well, certainly a consistent prediction of climate science is that we should get more extreme weather in all its forms, not just heat waves, but also precipitation events. There's more energy in the climate system now than there was in the past. So it's able to evaporate more water from the surface and from the oceans, which dries out the landscape and makes it more prone for fire, also creates the conditions where you can have record-breaking floods as well as heat waves. So these extreme events, whilst they've occurred in the past, are consistent with what we would expect with climate change in terms of them becoming more frequent. So I think this is a major concern, that what we're seeing in Australia are the sort of events that are predicted to be common in the next 50 years. Well, they're apparently becoming common even as we speak. So that is perhaps one indication that the rate of change in the climate system is at the upper end of what predictions such as the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change may have anticipated.
And people talk about adapting to climate change. We've already seen Australian farmers abandon long-held property for lack of water, and now it seems like just living in a well-treated area might be dangerous. Is the only possible adaptation perhaps to abandon parts of the country in the long run? Do you think that's taking it too far? I mean, think about Secretary Stephen Chu now in the U.S. He suggested that agriculture might end in California.
I think what will certainly end is wasteful practices. And Australia's agriculture has been characterized by a waste of water. Australia is a very dry continent, so agriculture is difficult in many parts, and we've been dependent on irrigated agriculture from a couple of our large river systems. But on a per capita basis, because Australia is so sparsely populated, there's actually still a lot of water. Australia's in the top third of all countries for available water. So it's been a poor use of water that's caused devastation in these river systems, an over-allocation of water for irrigation, and all of these problems. Now, in the case of California, climate change is going to lead to a major shortage of water at certain key times. For instance, in summer, when the rivers were fed by snowpack melt, that is going to decline dramatically, and that will mean that what was once reliable stream flows will no longer be the case. There is scope for adaptation in all of these changes. We can look at more water-efficient agriculture, for instance. We can look at changing where we grow certain crops and where we undertake pastoral agriculture. But it's going to be a major challenge that means business as usual, and what we have come to expect as being a productive landscape will not necessarily be that way, even within the next few decades.
Dr. Brooks, you've also promised part two of your article, How Much Warming is in the Pipeline. I have to admit, I haven't found it yet, and I can't wait. How much warming is developing, even if we stopped all these greenhouse gases?
A major problem is that there are two big effects people are having on the climate system. One of them is a warming effect from CO2 and other greenhouse gases. But the other, which is somewhat balancing this, is a cooling effect from low-level tropospheric aerosols. These are pollutants such as sulfates that come from coal-fired power stations and vehicle emissions. A city like LA, for instance, is a classic example of the low-lying haze and smog. That's a dimming effect that causes less sunlight to reach the surface than otherwise would. And globally, that has a cooling effect on the climate. The worst situation is in Asia, where there's a lot of fires which burn animal dung, and of course a lot of new coal-fired power stations that are not capturing their sulfate emissions. All of this adds up to a cooling effect on the climate that may be as high as about half of the warming effect that we would otherwise have expected. Now, if you get rid of all of the dung burning and vehicle emissions and coal-fired power stations that will be required to stop the ongoing build-up of greenhouse gases, and you also remove the major source of that cooling effect. All that comes to a head when we talk then about how the climate is going to rebalance itself. And the best evidence is we've got about 2 to 2.5 degrees of warming in the pipeline. So if we shut off all greenhouse gas emissions now, because we're also shutting off aerosol emissions, we've got a lot more warming on the way.
I was wondering if even the current economic crisis might cause enough factories to shut down and enough people to drive less that perhaps we might see a slight increase in warming just from that reduction.
I think that's a very likely hypothesis. It's been speculated that the global financial crisis may cause almost certainly will cause a reduction in the amount of greenhouse gases going in the atmosphere because of reduction in industries. But that's a long-term effect. That takes years and decades to accumulate its effect in terms of warming, as it's happened in the last 50 years. But as soon as those factories stop producing sulfate aerosols, that's all washed out of the atmosphere within weeks. And so that's a very rapid effect. So I agree with you strongly that the net effect of the economic downturn is likely to be an extra pulse of warming rather than cooling, even if in the long term it has a slight cooling effect on the planet in terms of fewer greenhouse gases being released each year.
We do live in an ironic universe. If we clean up, it might actually hurt us in the short run. I'm thinking, too, about the situation in Australia. There's less media coverage of heat deaths, but heat deaths definitely do go up along with these spikes in the temperature, obviously.
Heat deaths are important. People get stressed in times when they can't cool down, so when there's extended hot periods. Now, in the past, a lot of people have died in severe heat waves because they've had no access to air conditioning. That was the situation in Europe in that extreme summer of 2003, when it was about 5 degrees hotter than the average, and there were certain times when Europe got up to over 40 degrees Celsius, which is over 100 Fahrenheit. So these are very stressful times. In areas where people can't adapt, can't essentially burn extra greenhouse gases by switching on air conditioner, they will suffer more. And so we're likely to see more heat-related deaths in areas of the world that are heating up at least as rapidly as the developed world but have no access to forms of adaptation that can actually allow you to cool down. And, of course, as we've seen in Australia, when you get persistent hot, dry weather and hot, dry winds coming in off the continent, which are drawn out of the continent by unusual weather systems, that's what creates tinderbox conditions that allows wildfires to erupt, and that's what happened in southern Australia, where we've had over 170 people killed in the wildfire events that followed the extreme heat wave of February 2009. These are the sort of dramatic events that are going to increase in frequency as the climate continues to warm and become more energetic.
Well, you know, whether we're scientists or not, it's going to be tough to watch some of these events and deaths increasing. I wonder, what's your personal reaction to these tragedies?
I think we have to make sure that the suffering of people involved in these tragedies, the damage caused, are not in vain. In other words, that we recognize these as the major warning signals, the flashing red light saying we've got to do something to avoid even more disastrous events occurring in the future, because it's quite clear that on our current business as usual pathway, these events will become appallingly regular, and it will reach the point that in many places we simply can't adapt. Too many people are being killed by climate change, too many areas are becoming uninhabitable, and the world as we know it will be totally transformed. We're not at that point right now, or at least I think the balance of probability is that we're not at that point. But it does suggest that we have to move into emergency mode, change our energy supplies to those that don't release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, be more sensible about how we live with a more dynamic climate system in terms of adapting with our agriculture, the way we build cities and houses, the way we treat the natural environment. These are major lessons of which we're only seeing the first portends of a very dark future. Now, we can avoid that, much like Scrooge in the Dickens tale of the Christmas Carol, witnessing the ghosts and avoiding a dark future. We can do the same, but we have to listen to the ghosts. And things like the heat wave and the bushfires that have occurred in Australia this year, Hurricane Katrina a few years ago, these are the ghosts telling us to avoid a dark future.
We've been talking with Professor Barry Brook. He holds the Sir Hubert Wilkins Chair of Climate Change at the University of Adelaide. As we wrap up, is there anything you'd like to add for our North American listeners?
I guess I'm very excited about the new administration in the US and the fact that they've appointed people with strong scientific credentials who recognize the seriousness of this problem. I've been talking a lot about potential solutions on my blog, and people are welcome to come and visit there as well to hear more of my thoughts on climate change and energy solutions. And the web address for that is bravenewclimate.com.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Professor Brook, thank you so much for helping us out.
It's a pleasure.
This is Radio EcoShock. Check out our website at www.ecoshock.org.
It seems to have moved north up the coast.
Sacre bleu! I cannot believe Mother Nature would do such a terrible thing.
might be what's behind this creeping desert business.
Mayhem! Mask!
What's the point coming all this way? Making deserts in a day.
We used to listen to some scientists predicting that the Mediterranean may become a desert in some decades from now. And we were thinking that this is in the sphere of science fiction. But it seems from all the reports that are coming through that this may be a reality if we don't take urgent steps. On the sphere of natural disasters emanating from these climatic changes, we have witnessed last year devastating forest fires in southern Mediterranean, in Greece, in Portugal, in Italy, in France. And the same thing applies to northern African or Middle Eastern countries.
What's the use, Mother Nature say, making deserts in a day?
The Kumtag is China's sixth largest desert, and state media reports it is creeping closer and closer to the city of Dunhuang in China's far west, creeping at a rate of between 1 and 4 meters each year. 90% of the city has already surrendered to desertification. This highlights a growing problem in China. Large tracts of land in the country's arid western provinces are turning from farmlands into deserts.
Someone out there's playing a deadly game. Cutting down a wounded land in pain.
Environmentalist Chen Ji Chun says now it is nearly an irreversible process.
It's hard to restore the original vegetation because there is very little water. You cannot plant anything where there is no water.
China's State Forestry Administration says the advance of the desert results in a direct annual loss of billions of dollars, while threatening the livelihoods of some 400 million people.
There's a hole in the sky where the sun gets through, burning every which way, from the top to the bottom of the food chain to in the middle of a desolate plain. What's the point coming all this way, making deserts in a day?
Climate change causing desertification in Mongolia. The climate in Mongolia has become more extreme, with summer droughts, harsh winters, dust storms and blizzards. Dr. Punsalma Batima, a member of the Nobel Prize-winning International Panel on Climate Change, leads a government project on improving water management in Mongolia. She described the growing climate hazards that the semi-arid country has already begun to face.
There's also a number of IPCC reports recognizing that the mountainous and semi-arid region is very vulnerable to climate change, and Mongolia also facing the same situation. It's really very dangerous because when very extreme precipitation is increased and mild precipitation is decreased, and you know the land and soil cannot get sufficient moisture, you know the vegetation and the ecosystem is degrading.
What's the use, Mother Nature say, making deserts in a day?
These people are members of the Pul tribe, nomads and herders by tradition. They've lived on the fringes of the desert for centuries, but each year the desert spreads, and places that used to be semi-arid are now too dry to support them. Most have now given up their nomadic ways. Life has been reduced to little more than an endless search for water, a problem made worse by the large herds of animals that the Pul keep. Not only must they find water for themselves, but for their animals as well. Being their only means of livelihood, the animals come first. And with the Sahara growing by thousands of square kilometres every year, this struggle for survival will only intensify.
There's a life the size of a grain of sand, dying every day. Now the time that we listened and we made a stand, before it gets too late.
More than 800 wildfires are burning across Northern California today. A lightning storm, officials called unprecedented.
The wildfires burning in California aren't growing, but there is still no sign of relief yet. Northern California now has more than 1,400 fires, and a warning for extreme fire danger remains in effect for today.
What's the point coming all this way? Making legends in a day.
And I think the story is kind of bleak, potentially, for the Western United States. All right. Here's a picture that our colleague Craig Allen from the U.S. Geological Survey took in northwestern New Mexico in 2002 fall. These trees, it's fall, right? The trees should be changing color. No. These are pinyon pines. The reason they're changing color in this pinyon juniper woodland is because all of the pinyon pines over tens of thousands of square kilometers are dying. Or now, are dead. But this drought, which is the worst drought in the instrumental record, has killed a lot of trees, and it's not just in the pinyon juniper woodland. So the big deal here is that this drought is being made a lot worse, probably, by global warming. And that's the kind of situation we're going to have increasingly in the future, and you're going to see whole-scale landscape transformation as a result. We're going to see not only die-off of species in trees, we're going to see major wildfire, and we're going to see a change in vegetation that's adapting the landscape across the West to a warmer, drier reality.
The shock was so intense, they say they all got paralyzed. Sahara, we sympathize with you. Sahara, we'll soon be dry.
That song was Making Deserts in a Day by the Henry Gorman Band. You heard audio clips from correspondence to the Australian newspaper, plus the BBC, the Daily Telegraph, Voice of America, Arizona scientist Jonathan Overpeck, IRN, and UNEP. We now go to a brand new interview with Thomas Homer Dixon. Last year, we ran a show by KMO, creator of the Sea Realm podcast. That's Sea-Realm podcast. Now KMO offers this chat with Homer Dixon. Listen for the way our economic collapse mirrors the sudden changes made by nature.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, KMO. And joining me is Thomas Homer Dixon. He holds the Center for International Governance and Innovation Chair of Global Systems at the Balsillie School of International Affairs in Waterloo, and is a professor in the Center for Environmental and Business in the Faculty of Environment, University of Waterloo. He is the author of three award-winning books, the most recent of which is The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization. Thomas Homer Dixon, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's terrific to be with you.
You have provided a reading from your new book. It is called Carbon Shift, How the Twin Crises of Oil Depletion and Climate Change Will Define the Future, and I'll be playing that later in the program. But first, I am interested in talking about economic matters, and in particular, I keep coming back to the work of Buzz Holling, which you describe in your book, The Upside of Down, and there's one sentence that I would like to read, and then have you explain what that sentence means, and it might take quite a bit of explaining. And the sentence is this. So, we're overextending the growth phase of our global adaptive cycle.
Well, okay, that's a good place to start. Now, your listeners have to realize that preceding that sentence was about 10 pages of spade work in which I sort of defined each of the concepts in that sentence and explained why it's each concept is important and how they work together. But let me walk through that very quickly for your listeners. First of all, a bit about Buzz Holling. He's a remarkable man. He's an ecologist, Canadian ecologist, now I think approaching 80 years old, still completely vigorous, full of life, and still making a terrific intellectual contribution. He pioneered the investigation of the cycles of adaptation that occur in ecological systems. He started by looking at the spruce forests in New Brunswick in Canada, went on to look at many other ecological systems. And to sort of compress a very long story, he discovered that you could describe the cycles of adaptation and development of ecological systems as occurring in a space, a three-dimensional space, an abstract space, characterized by three variables along each axis of the three-dimensional space. You can think of a cube. One variable is potential, one variable is connectedness, and one variable is resilience. So let's keep those three variables in mind, potential, connectedness, and resilience. By potential, he basically means the amount of information in a system or the capital available in a system. So if you're thinking of a forest, and he uses a forest as a sort of central example, as it's growing and becoming more mature over time, it builds its potential. It builds, in particular, the total biomass in the forest, the amount of genetic information in the forest, especially if the forest is becoming more diverse with different species and so there's more information in total, genetic information, more capital, more biomass in a sense in that forest. So the potential is increasing. As the forest matures, it also becomes more connected. All the elements, the species, of plants and animals become very tightly interwoven with movements of energy and chemicals and elements back and forth between them, and on a daily basis, and then even on by seconds, and so there are many different time frames operating. You have very short time frames. You have very long time frames that may endure over periods of years with these cycles of materials through all the connections between the species and the organisms in the forest. So that's the connectivity, and that tends to increase over time too. But then the third variable moves in an opposite direction. He discovered that as a forest reaches its most mature stage, it tends to become less resilient. So resilience actually declines. And by resilience, he means the ability to withstand a shock without falling apart, without catastrophic failure. So the forest actually becomes more and more vulnerable to a kind of collapse as it gets older, as its connectivity increases, and as its potential increases. One of the reasons is that because it's so connected, if there's, for instance, a fire or a disease, some kind of pathogen that infects the forest, because the forest is now so connected together, that shock, the fire, the disease, will spread through the forest very quickly and produce a collapse of a larger portion of the ecosystem.
You are listening to Thomas Homer Dixon, author of The Ingenuity Gap, The Upside of Down, and now a new book, Carbon Shift. The rest of this interview for Radio EcoShock, done by Sea Realm podcaster KMO, will return in just 30 seconds.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. We'll continue with Thomas Homer Dixon speaking to Sea Realm podcaster KMO about the way nature handles catastrophe.
But there's another thing that happens that's very interesting. As forests become mature, they tend to become very efficient in converting energy and water and the nutrients in the soil into biomass. And they actually start to eliminate redundancy within the forest ecosystem. So a good example would be nitrogen fixers. All ecosystems require a certain number of organisms called nitrogen fixers to take nitrogen out of the atmosphere and convert it into a form that can be used by plants and then and convert it into proteins in animals. Now, as a forest becomes more mature, the diversity of nitrogen fixers actually declines. Ones that aren't absolutely essential are eliminated from the mix of species that are nitrogen fixers, and the forest becomes more and more reliant on a relatively small number of nitrogen fixers. So it's losing resilience. It's becoming more efficient at processing, converting energy, material and nutrients into biomass, but it's actually becoming more brittle. It's losing resilience. That's the basic model. The hypothesis that Holling puts forward and the researchers who've worked with him, and it's now borne out by a lot of research, is that all complex adaptive systems, and these can include things like market economies, even societies, ecological systems like forests, tend to cycle in this three-dimensional space. They have a growth phase, which is the front loop of the cycle, as referred to in that sentence. They have a growth phase during which the forest or the economy or the society will become more connected, more complex, and will build its potential in terms of its information content and its capital. But over time, will start to lose resilience. At the top of that growth phase, the system becomes very brittle. With a forest, it becomes very vulnerable to disease or to a fire. And when there's a shock of that kind, the system actually collapses. It falls apart. And then there's a back phase of the adaptive cycle, or what they call the back loop, which involves the system reorganizing itself, recombining its components in new ways so that it can be adapted to the new environment that it's in. Now, here's the critical point, and this is really very powerful that comes out of this research, is that these researchers are suggesting that every highly adaptive system has to have a breakdown phase, what they call the omega phase in its cycle. And that breakdown, that loss of resilience, breakdown, crisis, and reorganization of the components of the system are essential to adaptation. This is what the great economist Joseph Schumpeter in the 20th century called creative destruction in market economies. He pointed out that the reason the market economies are so adaptive is that they allow for creative destruction. A company will be founded, it will grow over time. If it's well run, it will prosper. It'll become larger, grow in its potential, but over time it may lose resilience and may become badly adapted to a changing economic environment. It might go bankrupt eventually, and the human and financial capital of that company can be reorganized in the economy to provide for adaptation. And the overall process is one of really fast and effective adaptation for the economy as a whole. This is a radical idea, and just to conclude my summary of Holling's ideas and their implications. I think the larger story here, and it's one I try to develop in the book, is that our global socio-ecological economic system, and we've really now, humankind has created a tightly coupled, highly connected, high potential, global socio-ecological economic system with trade links and movements of material and energy, and with human beings being as large an actor in ecological sense as nature itself on the planet. That system is probably close to the top of the growth phase of the cycle. And in fact, in many respects, we might have prevented through our management smaller breakdowns that could have allowed us to adapt, and now we're looking at the possibility of very large breakdowns because we've prevented smaller breakdowns in the past. We have lost resilience. And I think the story of this financial crisis that we're going through right now is exactly the kind of thing that Holling was talking about. It's exactly the kind of thing that I anticipated within my book, The Upside of Down. We have an extremely brittle global economy that now is generating cascading failures that are affecting literally billions of people around the planet.
I'd like to read one other sentence, and this is from the previous page. It's another short sentence, but it's not quite so packed as the previous one. And it is this: the longer people sustain a social, economic, or ecological system in its growth phase, the sharper, harder, and more destructive its ultimate breakdown will be. And it seems that the promise of any politician is that he will extend the growth phase of the adaptive cycle at least out through the end of his administration, and thereby not be around when the eventual collapse comes. Now, they don't admit that a collapse is inevitable. The adaptive growth cycle model is not something that is, you know, incorporated into the presentation of where they think we're going. We are sold a message of continual economic growth that will go on indefinitely. And it seems to me that there are a lot of people who are very hopeful right now that the Obama administration will manage to somehow extend the growth phase of our adaptive cycle for another 4 or 8 years and thereby make the eventual crash all that much worse. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that specific application of the general topic we've been discussing.
Well, you've got it exactly right. We ask our leaders, whether they are business leaders, corporate leaders, political leaders, basically to keep things the way they are on the current trajectory. And the current trajectory has been growth and increase in connectivity and complexity. And we want them to keep us on that trajectory. And the implication, if Holling and these other theorists are correct, is that all that's going to do is make the eventual crisis that much worse, the breakdown that much worse. Now, you can tell a story about the current economic crisis in exactly these terms. We would have been a lot better off if policymakers and bankers hadn't manipulated the economic incentives and the economic conditions to allow for the creation of these enormous equity bubbles over the last couple of decades. And I can remember a very prescient cover in The Economist, I think it was back in the mid-1990s, and it showed a picture of a trader, probably of Wall Street or something like that, falling out of a skyscraper, you know, obviously having thrown himself out because of a financial crisis. And the headline across the front of the Economist was, "Crash, damn it." And what the Economist editors were arguing is that we'd be a lot better off if there were small breakdowns in the system fairly regularly, which would mean small economic crashes, rather than trying to manipulate the system in such ways by reducing interest rates and covering people's economic bets, allowing people to build up enormous debts, by manipulating the system in various ways so that these small crises don't occur. In terms of an ecological system like a forest, the parallel is really quite extraordinary. What you want in a forest is smaller, more regular shocks, say fires, that don't wipe out large sections of the forest, but open up space for adaptivity that allow light in, that clear the land, that allow for change of various kinds, the introduction of new species, rearrangement of relations among species. What you don't want to do is prevent forest fires over long periods of time, because then you get an accumulation of an enormous amount of biomass that's extremely flammable. And when you do have a fire, it's an enormous fire, it's extremely hot. And as Holling points out, it's so hot that it destroys the seeds that will allow for the regermination of a forest subsequently. So it actually destroys the potential for creativity and adaptation. And in many respects, that's what we ask in asking our politicians and leaders to keep things as they are, to maintain growth indefinitely, to allow the front loop of the growth cycle, of the adaptive cycle, to be extended indefinitely. We're actually increasing the probability that we're going to have a crisis that's so large eventually that we won't be able to adapt. We won't be able to respond creatively. That's a pathological outcome of the adaptive cycle. And I think, again, Holling is very insightful about this.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, KMO, and I'm joined by Thomas Homer Dixon. He is the author of several books, including the award-winning The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization. And we have been talking about growth phases and adaptive cycles and how the extending of the growth phase of an adaptive cycle makes the eventual correction all that much more severe and jarring. And I would like to talk a bit about employment and what you call in your book the growth imperative, and how that relates to employment and how that relates to the money supply and technology. And again, this is a very large question, and it will require a long answer, so I will stop talking and let you approach that from whichever angle you think is most effective.
That's a question that, of course, is central to our current crisis, but it's one that doesn't get asked, and I find that somewhat discouraging. I think it will get asked more as time goes on, but there are some actually very deep contradictions and inconsistencies, you might say, within our current economic system. To put the argument in its shortest form, it's that we are obliged to maintain growth, because if we don't, our societies will fall apart, not just our economies, but what growth does is it provides a lubricant between rich and poor, and it allows for some semblance of social stability, because we haven't dealt with the underlying problems of inequity, of disparities between rich and poor, and we cope with them over long periods of time by generating economic growth that allows for some trickle down and expands the overall pie so that everybody can feel happy enough that they don't revolt against the system. As soon as growth stops, you have the prospect of a zero-sum competition between rich and poor. Now, we learned a very tough lesson in the 1930s that I think has penetrated deeply into our culture, and especially the culture of economists and economic policymakers. And that lesson is that a failure of demand, a failure of consumption in an economy can be catastrophic. A deflationary cycle can be catastrophic because it sends unemployment skyrocketing. And when you have very high unemployment, especially a rapid rise of unemployment following a period when the economy was doing reasonably well, you can get political radicalization, and you can get the development of social pathologies such as national socialism. And we saw the consequences of that. It cost 50 million lives and produced the Holocaust. And the policy response, one of the most important policy responses to that social disaster, was Keynesian economics and the adoption of Keynesian economics, which is basically an economic system or theory that allows for the perpetuation of growth indefinitely, economic growth. And here's the reason, the underlying problem that you were alluding to in your question. Capitalist market economies are extraordinarily adaptive, and they are adaptive in large part because they generate constant technological change. Firms compete with each other to reduce their costs so they can reduce the prices of the goods and services that they sell and capture more market share. One of the principal ways that they can reduce their costs is by increasing the productivity of capital, of the machinery that they use, of the physical plant, the factories that they use, producing more widgets essentially per unit of labor. So they want to increase the productivity of capital, and they want to increase the productivity of labor. But one of the results is that, especially when it comes to labor, if you increase the productivity, you don't need as much of it. So there is a constant process of displacement, technological displacement of labor in our economies. Quite understandable, quite natural. There's no malign intent here on the part of companies. They're just doing what they have to do to survive. They need to increase the productivity of capital and labor, and in the process, they use fewer and fewer people to produce the same stream of goods. Now, those people who are disemployed by technological change have to be absorbed somehow if you're not going to have the development of a potentially easily radicalized group of people within a society who are unemployed or underemployed. And the way we've learned how to do that, what Keynes basically showed us, was we've learned mechanisms for maintaining economic growth to absorb that technologically displaced labor, especially by maintaining consumption. We have to maintain consumption. Of course, this technologically displaced labor has to be reemployed in the economy so that it can be consuming stuff, so those people who would otherwise be unemployed can be consuming things because otherwise they are going to contribute to a demand failure in the economy too. So the whole point of economic growth is to keep the expansion of the economy sufficient to absorb workers who would otherwise be unemployed, especially by technological change. Now, the figures are really quite astonishing. On an annual basis in the United States, the American economy needs about 3% growth in real terms simply to prevent unemployment from rising. Now, that's partly because the population is growing and there's immigration, but a very significant portion of that 3% goes towards absorbing unemployment that's created by technological change. So we're hooked on growth. If we don't maintain growth, we're going to have steadily expanding unemployment in our economy, and that will have really disastrous social consequences. We've learned, I think, over time, partly because of the lessons of the Depression and then the Second World War that followed, that growth equals peace. And I think even going farther back in history, we've learned the lesson even drawn from, say, the Enlightenment and perhaps even farther back to the notions of progress that developed in the Renaissance, that growth equals freedom. Now, that's a very powerful cultural combination. Growth equals peace and growth equals freedom. And it's very difficult for anybody to challenge the assumption that growth is a good thing. Of course, on the other side of this equation, we have a global ecosystem that's increasingly showing the consequences of this perpetual growth. We have a world climate that is changing because of the enormous output of waste from the global economy. The World Bank anticipates that the global economy will grow at 3% a year, in real terms, 2.5 to 3% a year, more or less indefinitely into the future. Obviously, that's not going to happen for the next couple of years because of the economic crisis, but that's its anticipated target growth rate. Well, that produces a doubling time of around 20 years. Every 20 years, the global economy will double, every 20 to 25 years, in real terms, in terms of its real economic output. We're already at a $70 trillion global economy. If we go out 40 or 50 years into the future with a 3% growth rate, doubling every 20 to 25 years, that means we will quadruple the size of the global economy by the time my children are my age, from $70 trillion to pretty close to $300 trillion. That's not going to happen. We have a global environment that's already suffering the consequences, the really dramatic consequences in terms of its incapacity to absorb the waste from our economic output. We have a resource system that's under stress, particularly in terms of energy production and the ability to find the energy we need to drive our global economy. Even at $70 trillion, it's simply inconceivable that an economy of $280 trillion is going to be sustainable within the finite limits of this planet. So we face a really absolutely inescapable contradiction, in a sense, between the underlying need for growth to maintain social stability on one hand and the imperatives of our global ecology on the other. And nobody's really talking about this, but we need to because it's probably the central crisis of this century.
Well, that is a frustrating place to have to end, but I realize that you have a meeting starting in less than 10 minutes. So,
I suppose that means we just have to have another conversation before too long.
Well, I would like to do that after I've had a chance to read Carbon Shift.
Very good.
Well, Thomas Homer Dixon, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the program, and I would very much like to invite you back to continue this conversation, and I'm sure that the audience would like to have you back as well.
Well, KMO, it has been a delight, as usual. I really enjoy these conversations, and your questions are always right to the point and really take us places that I rarely get taken in my interviews. So thanks very much. It's been terrific.
That was KMO with Thomas Homer Dixon. My thanks to Kay for his important interview. Check out his podcast at c-realmpodcast.podomatic.com. That's c-realmpodcast.podomatic.com. It's a good one to tune into. His blog is at kmo.livejournal.com. Now, Thomas Homer Dixon reads from his new book, Carbon Shift, How the Twin Crises of Oil Depletion and Climate Change Will Define the Future.
August 22, 2027. Ilisat, Denmark, Reuters. A steady flow of scientists, journalists, Danish officials, and eco-spectators has arrived in this settlement on the west coast of Greenland as thousands of icebergs break off the nearby Jakobshavn Glacier each day and stream past the town. In the last 4 weeks, the glacier has surged off the Greenland landmass, producing a sharp acceleration of ice discharge into the North Atlantic. Glaciers elsewhere on both the east and west coasts of Greenland have shown similar dramatic acceleration of ice loss. Scientists believe these developments signal the start of large-scale disintegration of Greenland's ice sheets and rapid rise of the world's sea levels. What kind of future are we handing our children? If it includes news stories like the one I've just read, today's generation of adults will have failed to meet one of its most fundamental responsibilities, to ensure our children's safety, security, and opportunity to flourish. Every day that we deny, dissemble, and delay, and every day that we avoid the tough choices and costs of dealing with our twin energy and climate crises, we make it more likely that, at some point, our children, perhaps as young adults, will wake up in a world in which they no longer control their climate fate, in which, for instance, it's too late to stop the collapse of the planet's great ice sheets. Although the authors of this book's chapters disagree about many things, they all agree fundamentally that we need to change how we see the world and how we act. In our everyday lives, we need to see and understand the energy and climate consequences of our behavior, and we need to change that behavior to protect our children's future. All the authors here are deeply frustrated by the half-heartedness of our efforts so far and the current poverty of serious proposals to alter our direction, and they all fear that we won't take these challenges seriously until it's too late. In the period during which this book was written and edited, the world seemed to go haywire. An economic bubble created by decades of cheap credit and the undervaluing of risk, centered in the U.S. housing sector but replicated in different ways in economies around the world, imploded, producing a financial crisis of astonishing breadth, depth, and persistence. Commodity prices that had rocketed upward suddenly collapsed as demand vanished and hedge funds and other speculators sold their positions to pay down their debts. Oil, which spiked to $147 a barrel in June 2008, plummeted below $60 by mid-November 2008. But almost unnoticed in the background of this tumult, companies and utilities were ramping up their use of coal, and humankind's emissions of carbon dioxide shot past the worst-case scenario of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. In the summers of 2007 and 2008, Arctic ice disappeared at record speed. Meanwhile, in British Columbia and in federal politics, Canadians showed scant enthusiasm for proposals to tax carbon emissions. When it comes to our energy and climate problems, we're going in diametrically the opposite direction to where we should be going. And while the world's current economic crisis legitimately demands policymakers' attention, its consequences, no matter how severe, will pale beside the long-term consequences to humankind of energy scarcity and climate change. For all their capacity to radically alter nearly every facet of our civilization, these threats rarely capture our imaginations. They develop incrementally, and their consequences are both uncertain and relatively distant in time and space. They are what specialists call wicked problems. As David Keith points out in his chapter here, climate change in particular is characterized by high uncertainty and high inertia. Systems with lots of uncertainty and inertia are notoriously hard to control because we can't effectively predict their future behavior and we can't quickly correct behavior we don't like. So such systems give us enormous scope for denial and procrastination. But the carbon challenge is real, and deep change in our lives, economies, and societies is inevitable. It would be a mistake to conclude from the disagreements between the experts in this book that we should wait to see what happens before we act. David Keith and David Hughes may argue about the relative importance of climate change and fossil depletion. Mark Jacquard and Jeff Rubin may disagree on whether markets will accurately price the energy that powers our civilizations. But to interpret these disagreements as reasons to delay would be a self-serving rationalization, just as self-serving as the commonplace rationalizations highlighted by William Marsden and Jeffrey Simpson, that we can enjoy the wealth and energy of the tar sands without acknowledging the staggering environmental costs, and that we can soothe our consciences by endorsing a green political agenda, even as we vote for parties and policies that fail to address the problems we claim we want solved. All the authors in this book agree we face a series of challenges that will shake our priorities, our assumptions about our entitlements, and our expectations for the future. Whether the risk is that humankind will release enough of Earth's stored carbon to make the planet uninhabitable, as David Keith fears, or that humankind will find there aren't enough hydrocarbons in the ground to keep the global economy operational, as David Hughes warns, a carbon shift, either voluntary or involuntary, is now unavoidable. It had better be voluntary. To do little or nothing now in the face of inevitable change is to invite disaster, if not upon ourselves, then upon future generations. In fact, one way or the other, whether we change our behavior or not, we're betting the fate of our children, and the simple question is, which bet do we want to make? Do we bet that energy scarcity and climate change aren't going to hurt the world badly and invest our resources elsewhere? If we're right, we save some money, but if we're wrong, the consequences for our children could be catastrophic. Or do we bet that energy scarcity and climate change could indeed hurt the world badly and invest to prevent that outcome? If we're right, our children avoid possible catastrophe. But if we're wrong, we lose some money. Put this way, the answer seems obvious. Investment now to prevent potentially catastrophic consequences in the future, even very significant investment, is entirely rational. Or at least the answer should seem obvious if we weren't deeply hardened in our narrow, narcissistic, present-day self-interest.
That was Thomas Homer Dixon reading from his new book, Carbon Shift, as recorded by KMO. You have been listening to the Radio EcoShock Show. Find all our past programs as free MP3 downloads at the website ecoshock.org. That's ECOshock, like an electric shock, .org. I am amazed at the number of communicators listening to this show, either by radio or from our free podcast. I've had helpful emails from journalists, green activists, bloggers, other radio hosts, and general shit-kickers. Even scientists admit listening to our program. Thanks for all your tips. I couldn't do this program without such a supportive, interactive community. Keep it coming, please. Write me at any time. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. This is Alex Smith saying thank you for listening, and do join us again next week. Some of our background music was from Strategy by Canadian game whiz Paul Dickow. We'll go out with another Canadian artist, André Ethier, with his hit Infant King.
Now listen to the message from above. Well, the father is dead, reborn as a jackal. Raise your voices in song and lead your people in shackles. Let it rain. Let it rain. Oh, let it rain. Offer your tongue out into the atmosphere. From the foot of the strong, sing. I said the father is